Okay, yep.
Some peculiar structure in the insulating states at 1.5. Is it real?
1.5?
Yeah. All those white dots?
Those white dots.
At NS over 2.
NS over 2, this one. Oh, no, this is just, okay, so that state was quite insulating. So sometimes you need to make sure that you're passing a good current through it, yeah. So this is just an artifact, really, yeah. Okay, but that, to be said, in all those measurements, we also in parallel measure the current for the system, so it's all well calibrated and normalized. Okay, all right, so, okay, so and now, I guess, back to that question. So what does it all mean, right? So, I mean, I guess I can start, like, making different graphs, and I can start looking at the phase diagram close to -1/4, and I can say, okay, there's this state at -1/4, and then there's two potentially superconnected regions around it. I can do the same for charge neutrality, right? I can also, around charge neutrality, where we also see a gap, can start drawing those things. And then I can do it for +1/4. So and that's what the question was before. So I'm not sure we can start really interpret this right now. I think there are definitely those three possibilities, that the whole band seems to be superconducting, it's interrupted by the insulators. It could be maybe unlikely, but it could be that superconductivity comes from the 1/4 and the charge neutrality point. This is, I think,
so
up for the
interpretation. How sure are you, based again on your preliminary data, that 1/4 itself is definitely not superconducting? 1/4 itself, that 1/4 itself is an insulating state, it is not superconducting. I mean, is the data absolutely compelling that it's for sure it's not superconducting?
So okay, so I just come back.
That's all we can do. I'm
okay,
just trying to get the bias out of you.
Okay, so the +1/4. Okay, so +1/4 definitely goes up to like tens of kiloohms. That definitely here, I have to say that you can see that the superconductivity starts appearing below the peak. Okay, so this is basically what you can see in this graph. I think is that really the superconducting region here is really below the insulating region. Okay.
Yeah. Do you have a temperature cut of that, of this particular node?
Of this one?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't have it here, but we have all the data. Yeah.
So does it look like activated and so on?
No. Look, I mean, you mean?
Yeah, the waterfall state. Yeah.
No. So that's why I'm saying that at the -1/4, we don't see any activation.
Sorry, you did have activated plot for -1/4.
Well, plus one.
That was +1/4.
This was +1/4.
-1/4.
So -1/4 is much weaker, but I will show more data about the -1/4. Okay. All right. So okay. So then about the -1/4. So since we were just discussing it, so it, as I mentioned before, the -1/4 seems to get stronger with magnetic field, and we really get some sort of resistance peak in the state. But what happens really is that at higher magnetic field, there is all of a sudden, this state becomes much more resistive. And this is basically exemplified in this plot. So this is basically, again, the resistance trace along this line here when we ramp up the magnetic field, parallel magnetic field. And this state, again, is almost low resistive. But if we go to higher magnetic field at around 3.6 Tesla, all of a sudden there is a really strong resistance increase at that point.
You said parallel magnetic field. So yes. This is
parallel. Yeah.
Parallel to the sheet.
Sorry. Perpendicular. So it's all perpendicular. We don't have a parallel magnetic field. I'm sorry. Yeah. I have 9 hours jet lag in myself. Okay. Sorry. It's perpendicular. And basically, we see like all of a sudden a strong jump, and then here really, at higher magnetic field, this data, by the way, is 1 week old. So I don't have a full data set. But what really happens is that here, the state becomes much more resistive. And if we now sit here at finite field and now take a temperature dependence, there we see an activation behavior in this state as well.
It's a huge field.
Yes, it's a huge field. Okay, so what's more interesting, we see this in that state, okay? So basically, if we go along this line, this transition here is really, really sharp. So it's not just some crossover, it's really like a sharp resistance spike. And if we go up the field, we basically we see a up and down the field, we see a hysteresis. And the hysteresis is really the strongest directly at the one quarter. And if we go on the sides, left and right from that that state, we really see that this switching behavior disappears. Okay, and we see this in RxY, we see this in RxX. And furthermore, what we can say is that with temperature, the magnetic field transition becomes larger. So if I plot the HC2 of this, so at, the magnetic field at which this transition happens as a function of, of temperature, then this transition becomes, so the magnetic field grows with temperature. And vice versa, if I look at the size of this switching jump, if I look at the width of this magnetic field switching, then it goes down with temperature. Really, at around 1 Kelvin, there's basically the switching disappears. So really, something is happening there, which is there. So the VC of this is basically 0.5 Kelvin, I would say. So this happens only below those temperatures. And this seems to disappear with temperature as well.
Did you measure Rxy?
Yeah, this is Rxy.
Okay.
So it's both magnetic. So both Rxx and Rxy.
What are the values of Rxy?
Yeah, so you can see it's in the order of. Again, this data is just 1 week old,
Sorry, so,
yeah.
Yeah.
So this is in the order of. This is okay. So it is in the order of 15 kilo ohm. Okay.
Rxy or
Rxx? That's Rxx.
That's Rxx. What about Rxy?
It is in the yeah. This is several.
Well, the change is 500 ohms, but it's
yeah.
Those.
We're analyzing this data now. Yeah. So in a couple of days, I can show you the line cuts and temperature, mm-hmm. and I can show you really the values of that switcher.
But to clarify, these RxY are not centered around zero.
It's not centered around zero field. No.
This is all it.
No. So I think just to mention a word about this, I think if I would try to really carefully word, I think we can say that. So what we think is a potential explanation would be that it's like a magnetically fluctuating state at low field, and this magnetic state becomes ordered at a particular field. So I think we don't say it's ferromagnetism or something, but I think it's some sort of magnetically ordered state which is not well developed at low field, but it's stabilized by a high magnetic field. Yeah.
Can you go to the next slide again?
This one?
Yeah. So that. What this left plot is saying is that the critical field at which you see the hysteresis, is that how you define HC? What defines HC? The black line?
So the black line?
Defines HC.
Right, so this is this onset of this magnetic field
where
at which
the jump happens.
That jump happens, yeah.
Where the jump?
Where the jump happens.
Where the jump happens, like on the way up or something.
But because there's a width to the curve.
So in this case, if we go up in magnetic field, the jump happens at this point here. This is the value which we extract as HC.
Okay, but yeah. Now you're showing temperature dependence up here on the next slide.
Right.
Sorry. So if you kind of march up that curve,
right.
Is there at high temperature, you would think any hysteretic behavior should go away. So is there some shrinking of the hysteresis loop in magnitude or in width? As you go up in temperature?
Yeah, that's his red, that's his maroon point.
Oh, right. That's what that is. That's the width.
Right.
Okay.
The width goes just down to zero, yep.
So by 1 Kelvin, there's no hysteresis, right. But you still see the jump.
Yep.
And you haven't gone above 1 Kelvin to see whether the jump
right.
itself goes away.
Yep.
Okay.
Thank you.
If you go to negative magnetic field, do you still see the hysteresis?
Excuse me?
If you go to negative magnetic field.
If you switch the field direction,
yeah,
it shows no hysteresis.
Yeah, yeah. That's the same. It's symmetric, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so but these are at different densities. The ones on the right are different densities, but they're all at base temperature. The actual curves.
These ones?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're at base temperature.
They're at base temperature,
yeah,
but different densities.
Yes.
But you don't have those curves for different temperatures.
We have them, yeah.
I mean,
that's why how we extracted all of this.
That's how you extracted those.
Yeah.
But you do see a jump at 1 Kelvin.
We see a jump at 1 Kelvin at
no
around 4 Tesla.
Okay.
But the hysteresis goes away.
Got it.
Right. Okay. So this is basically this is almost it. So I just also want to show some last of the data. So we also measured Schubert-Kobde-Haas in the system. So in principle, I think if you look at the data, it looks very similar to what was observed in the previous work. Really, I think what's new is that we see this sort of magnetically ordered state appearing at high magnetic field. We also see that the plus one quarter behaves weirdly. So there's like the plus one quarter insulator, it has like a slope. I have no idea what this is. Which is not well seen on this, we now also see some Shubnikov-Dehaas oscillations which are diverted inwards. So I think if you look here, there's some Shubnikov-Dehaas oscillations which go inwards. Here maybe a little bit, here. So in principle, we think this is just like, this is just like the last slide. We really think if we zoom in here, we see also maybe some signatures of Hofstadter type of Van Dagger. But I think also the Landau Van Diagram suggests that this sample is rather on the cleaner side.
Do you see this like phase shift in the quantum oscillations around quarter filling on the whole band? You haven't plotted it. I'm just curious if it's... So we see at low density away from neutrality point like 4A12 sequence.
So here?
Yes, but then across quarter filling it's...
No, this is, I know what you mean. I don't see that.
You don't see that?
I mean, no.
They have a quarter filling.
Yeah.
Like, they have very strong features at quarter filling.
I'm sorry.
So right, they disappear here. Okay, yeah, so this is with this. Thanks a lot for your attention. And I guess we're ready for more questions.
Chair's prerogative to ask the obvious, but you know, what is different about how you made this?
No, but but again, I think I just want to mention that this is really data from one device right now.
Thought it was two devices.
No, this were one device which showed all of these superconducting magnetic type features. The other device showed really just that the second device was just very homogeneous also with twist angle.
Well, so it's all statistics at this point. Right? So.
We discussed this last week. To be honest, we really just talked to you guys and Pablo, and we just really tried to reproduce your recipe, really, with the graphite decade, etc. So I was like.
I'm glad you didn't reproduce it perfectly.
So to be honest, like we're debating right now what we might do different, but there's no obvious thing. Really, we go through it many times now, and it seems to be a very very similar recipe.
So I guess.
But I'll let you know if we find out. Yeah.
I guess the important question of Andrea and Matt. I mean, these results are obviously not inconsistent in anything that I have seen from Columbia, Santa Barbara, MIT. But do you have data which show some signatures of superconductivity in between?
Roughly speaking, I would say that we just haven't done that experiment.
Yeah, that's
the best sample was not measured below 300.
Right, this is okay. This is what I'm talking about. You didn't go to the dilution.
That's all I can say. Yeah. You know?
So that's what I meant. It's not inconsistent. Anything we
now, I would say that there's a certain quantitative inconsistency between the best device and that we measured and this device, in that assuming we're just looking at high temperature.
Yes.
Part of the phase diagram, then the strongest superconductors that we see are not where the strongest superconductors that EMA sees. If you go back to your color palette.
But in Pablo's case, going back, in Pablo's case, that's the strongest superconductor he sees.
So
in Pablo's case, it's also this one.
That's the strongest one we see. Yeah. That's consistent, but the next strongest one we see is on the right-hand side of plus NS over.
But then, this is what I remember.
Right.
Yeah, but then, that's different.
Yeah, okay. But the angle could be different, right?
Oh, the angle is definitely different because it was under pressure.
Right.
But that was generic over different angles and pressure.
We've had ambient devices.
This is what I was remembering also.
Yeah, that are
strength. If you just log the strength, from activation or something, but one doesn't know. Going below temperature, there could be some
If you took a cut at 300 millikelvin, or indeed a dirtier version of this device, it is different. Superconductivity is strong in different places for what is nominally a very similar device otherwise, except for the charge neutrality point gap, which we have not seen in these devices, and that seems like a rather big
difference. Although that hierarchy of the insulating states is consistent with what we have. Like half filling is strongest, three quarters filling is next strongest.
Right, yeah, that's right.
The remainder.
Basically, the rest are not well activated.
The rest are not well activated except NS over 4, which is resistive, and that's sort of the weakest one here. So
So I mean, that's what we discussed in principle. The quality of the device seems to be comparable to your pressure device, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So in principle, the gap features are all pretty similar, right?
Yeah, and yes. It's not like you see some features at zero field right. Where we don't see them, but you don't. None of the things. We only saw three states that had honest activated
right.
Insulating behavior, and I think that's consistent with mm-hmm. the three that you see, and everything else is kind of. Is it really an insulator? You know, it's a bit debatable.
Right.
There's a resistive peak, but it's not well activated. It doesn't
right.
go down
yeah.
very low.
Yeah.
And if you go back to the quality of device, how are you determining that? I mean, it's an important question.
So I mean, they're free. They're. I don't know what.
Mobility
you
is
something
like that.
Yes. 5-7 minutes. So that's fine. Yeah.
Okay. So I mean, for the quality of devices, we have basically. Yeah, two really strong evidences. This.
Hmm.
So we basically compare. Between very different contact pairs spread out over the whole device, where the gaps appear, and from that we can deduce a twist angle locally, and we can compare how it scales.
So we are talking
device.
About the distributions in the spatial inhomogeneity
right.
of the twist.
That's right. And actually, if you look at this,
Mike, Raphael,
I just want to mention this as well. If I look now at the charge neutrality point here,
yes,
we don't see that gap in charge neutrality everywhere in the sample.
Mm-hmm.
So if you see here, this curve it bends up. It doesn't go to zero. So I think it is a question whether, and I think in future we will probably see that when we get statistics, is whether this charge neutrality point gap also has something to do with homogeneity, or
is it possible to convert it to a single number like we do in semiconductor, like a mobility or something, high temperature mobility or something, because this is like an overall behavior.
Maybe
right.
So one way you could maybe think about that is like percentage strain.
Yeah,
so you have angle over distance.
It would be right. very useful
so, I mean,
to have something like that.
I mean,
right?
So, I was trying to come up with that.
Mm-hmm.
Explanation or that quantity.
Oh, okay.
Degree over
size.
Okay. Yeah. So
and you can turn that into
yeah.
a dimensionless
right.
strain.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then I just wanted to say the other quality feature is really this. So we really don't see any Fraunhofer's. You know. So I think that's also
that's is it in the center of the dome or close to the.
It's in the center.
Okay, Mike and Raphael and Nina, do you have a question? You next after
them. Do you know anything about the Hall conductance at the other quarters?
No. So basically, the reason I'm showing just this one is because in the others we didn't see anything. But that being said, also we were limited to 5 Tesla magnetic field. So there might be that it might be that, for example, at the 1/4, the 3/4, you just need a higher magnetic field to see that type of.
So it's
behavior.
Different than what David Goldhaber.
So was. Right. So
that was at zero field, right? That was
right. So you can see that we were actually quite lucky to see that because we ran out of magnetic field very quickly. So, yeah.
Okay.
So at -1/4, you apply a field, then you create an insulating state, or you see an insulating state.
That's right.
Right. My understanding was that at half feeling from Pablo's original paper is the opposite. You apply the field, you actually kill the insulating
right.
state.
Right. Yeah. That's right.
Is this all consistent, or
this is all consistent?
Do you see the same?
That being said, is again, I think in Pablo's case and also in your guys' case, the 1/2 was killed at around 6 or 7 Tesla, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't see that just because we don't have enough field.
But do you see the suppression of the insulating state to have?
But also, if you look at the data from these papers, it rather abruptly closes at around 6 or 7 Tesla.
Okay.
So I think it would be hard for me to say that there is really a closing right here.
Okay.
Going back to device number 2, like you haven't seen any sprocket activity there, or you haven't seen sprocket activity everywhere, or
okay. All right.
So like you said that thermal cycling, you have this charge neutrality point gap appeared.
Right.
Did you see sprocket activity after that?
So I have to say, so I think right. This data is from device number 2. Okay, so it up to like we measured it down to 5 Kelvin. Up to 5 Kelvin, it looked exactly the same as the other device. You know, it really looked. We were quite happy with that device originally. Then we measured it in another fridge, and which went down to 5 Kelvin. Then we transferred to the Dill fridge, and then we didn't see these behaviors. So one of the one of the speculations we have is that the device degraded in between. Okay? But in principle, up to 5 Kelvin, they looked exactly the same.
Oh, the gap disappeared after.
Yeah, so once we. Right, so.
In it?
He was first.
Mike?
Back on the Landau fan, both the plus and -1/4 gaps seem to be tilted. Do they just have slope?
one or two?
Okay.
Yeah, so it looks like both plus and minus 1/4, the gaps are sloped. Can you assign a Hall conductance to them?
Is that a gap?
We could. Yeah, we haven't done it yet, but we could, I think. Yeah, so I mean, it is. So your question is whether this is just like the first lambda level?
Yeah,
instead of, yeah, it could be, yeah.
One, two.
Yeah, but then you know the other thing is, if you look closely, then there, if one looks really carefully, then from that peak, all the other lambda levels seem to originate. So we see some sort of fanning out from this. So, but yeah, that's a possibility. Yeah.
Can you explain again where the homogeneity of 0.01 degree
right.
come from?
Okay, so this is right. So we measure the conductance between those two contacts, between those two. So basically, between every contact pair combination, we measure the conductance. And from the position of the gaps,
okay.
from the carrier position, the carrier density position of these gaps, we assign an angle, which we measure from this. And then I just averaged all the angles which we found over the device to the size of the device.
And it's less homogeneous than other groups.
So Corey shows in his talk one device which usually has, I don't know.
Oh yeah, this is
the peaks. The peaks are much more. Yeah.
Or that's good.
I thought that one had a more noticeable twist angle shift.
The pressure device is like this, save for one contact.
Save for one contact. Okay.
Have you measured the superconductivity between different contacts?
Yeah.
Is everything consistent?
So between those two contact pairs, we also see that there. So basically, the superconducting region was in the center of the device. So we measured the group of these two. Yeah. And also like RxX and RxY was like this and like that and like this as well.
So just I guess one comment that Gregory or Matt can confirm, but your high field, hysteretic state.
Right.
We've definitely seen. A weird resistive state that onsets very
yeah,
sharply.
Right.
We just thought it was a bad contact. We didn't look for hysteresis. As soon as I saw that, it was reminiscent. So whatever physics that is, I would venture to say it's probably not too strongly dependent on AV sublattice splitting or charge neutrality point gap, just because the devices are all long dead. We're never going to figure it out. But that feature is definitely in some of these other devices.
So that was your interpretation at that point of time.
I thought it was a bad contact. Yeah, it was just high field. It was hard to tell, but it looks.
Yeah,
like
yeah. No, I mean,
feature,
the surprising thing
is
it's quite reproducible because if you look at the, it's quite reproducible. So we could measure it over all the temperature ranges, over all the density ranges, all the magnetic field ranges. So this was like really a stable thing.
Yeah, the color plots, it's just
right.
Identical.
Yeah.
Under the other question.
When Pablo showed the data for one of his superconducting domes,
right.
He made the point saying that it's not exactly a nice dome. It's
right.
a heap of TC
inside yeah.
the dome. Suppose
yeah.
the exam is commensurate fitting.
Right.
Do you see anything like this?
Okay, I have to be honest. Like we haven't gone that far into analyzing our features yet. So we haven't looked exactly at the dome shapes. We haven't tried it compared to Coupe rates, or we haven't done it yet. But yeah. So we but if you have suggestions, we'll definitely take a careful look. Yeah.
All right. So I think we better end this anyway. I'm sure there'll be many more questions for Dima after the session is over, but let's move on to the next let's move on to the next talk and thank you.
This?
Yes.
We will start the lab.
We took it out here, but it's not gated conduction. So we measured it. Yeah.
Honestly, he might have been.
Hey there. Let me actually begin by thanking the organizers for putting together this wonderful workshop. I was not here last week, but I've been watching the talks online and still trying to catch up and looking forward to the rest of this week. I should also thank the organizers for asking me to speak, though I'm in a little bit of an awkward situation. So for those of you who don't know me, I'm a theorist, but I'm only going to talk about experiments today, experiments that I've been involved with. So I'm really doing a small... I knew that there will be some concern here the moment I said a theorist involved with experiments. So let me assure you that all the serious experiments were done in Pablo's group by these three gentlemen. So the caveat here is that neither of the two theorists involved with the study did any of the measurements. So irrespective of what I say later on regarding possible interpretations, the data is rock solid. Okay, so the paper appeared last week, and I guess Pablo mentioned it a little bit. So what I'm going to try and do is maybe talk about some complementary aspects and place these results in the broad context of what we know about unusual transport in a variety of strongly correlated systems. So I don't think I need to say this. This is what I'm going to be talking about, two sheets of graphene twisted slightly relative to each other. And for most of the talk, I'm going to focus exclusively on the phenomenology near magic angles. So this is a quick outline for the rest of my talk. I'm going to begin by only telling you about the phenomenology and just state the facts for what Pablo and his students have observed in the lab for transport in these magic angle devices. And then I'm going to compare these results with what we know in other strongly correlated systems, specifically the temperature-dependent transport. Then I will talk about some speculations and further interesting observations of mine, which hopefully will get resolved in the future. But unfortunately, at the very outset, I should say that I don't have a theory explanation for what they're seeing in their experiments. So just to make sure that all of us here are on the same page, at least as far as notation is concerned, let me just tell you what I mean by my filling. So suppose we are at large twist angles. So this is experiments going back to a couple of years ago, where the bandwidth of the isolated flat band was relatively large. So when you're exactly at half filling near charge neutrality, as seen here, that is what I call as my filling of nu equal to zero. And then if I go up in the conduction band, when nu corresponds to 4 electrons per Moray unit cell, that's nu equals 4. And then, of course, you see all the commensurate fillings here. Similarly, if I push my chemical potential down and go into the valence band, that's really emptying it out, so doping holes. So nu equals minus 4 corresponds to reaching the bottom of this band. And, of course, it's separated by a single electron gap because you get these band insulating stets at the two edges of this band. So, of course, in these experiments, no striking correlation effects were observed. As far as I'm aware, in Pablo's group, they haven't really studied these the temperature-dependent transport carefully in these large twist-angle devices. So now, what I'm really interested in is in the physics near magic angle devices, and I realized that this phase diagram is increasingly getting more and more obsolete. So in certain prehistoric times, sometime in the middle of last year, this is what the phase diagram looked like after these three initial papers. So actually, in fact, as soon as, so of course, what we know is that at various commensurate fillings, you see a variety of correlated ground states. So insulators, superconductors, now we know that there's more stuff happening at other commensurate densities. One of the things that I was immediately interested in last March when I became aware of these results is what is the nature of the metallic state as you go above the characteristic temperature scales associated with the superconductor and the insulator. Now, already in the first paper coming out of Pablo's group, there was something that I thought was a little striking at first glance. So, of course, the values of the resistance and also resistivity, because the aspect ratio of these devices is order one, was quite high. And irrespective of where exactly you are as a function of filling nu near the correlated insulator, if you go to sufficiently high temperatures, in this case, that's around 4 or 5 Kelvin, you start seeing that all of these resistivity traces are roughly similar. So I wanted to understand this better, so I started collaborating with Pablo and his group. So in the next few slides, I'm going to show you the transport phenomenology, in particular the temperature dependence of transport in a variety of different devices. So we have analyzed roughly 10 devices, and we see basically the same features in all of these different devices. So first of all, let me focus on transport near nu equals minus 2, which is the first correlated insulator that was reported last March. So before I actually begin, let me just say that what we find is that for a narrow range of fillings concentrated near this nu equals minus 2 and the nu equals plus 2 state, if we go to slightly high temperatures, now I will describe what I mean by high, we are seeing various unusual features. And over the rest of this talk, I'm going to emphasize on what is so unusual about this physics and what it is that we really have to explain and come to terms with. So first, if I focus on fillings near this nu equals minus 2, you see that, of course, at low temperatures, lots of different things are happening. There are at some fillings, the system is trying to go into an insulating regime. It's trying to go into a superconductor. And I should mention the color scale here corresponds roughly to these traces here.
So what the density variation here? I don't remember.
Yeah, it's around 10 to the 11 per centimeter squared.
But what do you remember the number from bottom to the top? Because half filling is a vague thing. I mean, what the density? That's for experimental.
I think it's there. I think it's the red, blue. Yes.
Color. That's
right.
The red to blue.
Right. Right, but that's still in terms of filling. I want in terms of per square centimeter. That's not the right. I'm talking about right.
Yeah, yeah, I know. So the correlated insulator roughly appears at minus 1.3 into 10 to the 12. Per centimeter square, and this whole range that's varying by around 10 to the 11 centimeters.
Something at 1.3 to 1.5 or 1.3 to 1.1.
Yeah.
But well, something.
I can check, and it's in the caption of my paper if you're.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Now, if you go to sufficiently high temperatures, these lines are becoming increasingly parallel. And in fact, if I just showed you this data, you would not even know that the system would want to either go into an insulator or a superconductor. Okay, so now the question is, what happens if I go to the other correlated insulator at nu equals plus 2? Now, this sample is what I think of as the poster child of what is so unusual about this device. So here, this is the zoom. The inset shows like the zoomed in data. So of course, again, the system is trying to go insulating or superconducting. Now, of course, if you go to higher temperatures, all of these lines are perfectly parallel straight lines, at least on this scale here. Now notice that this trace here, which corresponds to filling of plus 2 minus delta, so around the nu equals plus 2 correlated insulator, you're further doping it with holes, you see a perfect T-linear straight line that in fact goes all the way down to roughly 0.5 Kelvin and then becomes superconducting. Now of course, all the resistivities here are again in the range of a few kilo ohms, and the slopes, if you look at them here, they're all roughly equal. So now the question is all of this physics really just concentrated near these commensurate fillings, or do you see them elsewhere as well? So now if you can go and look near nu equals zero, which is near charge neutrality, now immediately you see that the values of the resistivities are smaller by maybe a factor of 5 or so. And at least in the same window of temperatures, for the first one-third, there's barely any change in the value of the resistivity. And okay, possibly you could say that it's starting to increase after that, but the slopes and the values are certainly nowhere near what we see near these correlated insulators. Again, here we are sweeping through, not me, the students are sweeping for a density range of roughly 10 to the 11 per centimeter squared. You can go further away. So now this is data near nu equals minus half. So somewhere here, the data is actually very similar even if you go to nu equals plus half, which is why I'm not showing it here. Again, you see that there is no striking T-linear resistivity extending all the way down to low temperatures. It's pretty flat, and then it starts picking up. So again, and the values are again quite small compared to what we see at either of the commensurate fillings. Similarly, one can look at plus minus 3 half. Now, of course, when you're going to plus minus 3 half, you're almost approaching the correlated insulators. But even then, for this minus 3 half state, again, this is the this is what the traces look like. Not reaching order 10 kilo ohms, not really obviously T-linear, though, for just to...
Curvature definitely changes qualitatively compared to the previous one.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, you could make the case that as you're approaching 3 half, which is really approaching the regime that we already scanned before, it is starting to look like it's T-linear.
But, okay. That's what's looking originally like, more like T-square, and this looks like the root T.
That is true, yes.
Is that really true? I did not know the level you analyzed that data, and there was not enough information for me to do it, and Pablo said they don't have data about 30 Kelvin.
We don't want
Other that. Possibility is that you have a linear regime,
yeah,
and you have, in all the data, a regime where it's nonlinear.
Yeah.
So that what you call coherence temperature, let's call that a crossover temperature, because you don't know whether there is coherence or not.
Yeah.
You're really talking about a crossover,
yeah,
in the empirical behavior.
Yeah.
So one thing that's consistent is that crossover temperature is changing, absolutely, and it's much higher here. So I asked Pablo, show me result above 30 Kelvin.
It doesn't have the
data. It'll look exactly the same as what it is. And of course, confidently, he didn't have data above 30 Kelvin. Okay.
But I can't comment on that. But yes.
I mean, it's consistent. You at least agree, right, that crossover temperature going up.
I agree. The puzzle, as I will emphasize later again, is why that crossover scale in some device goes down to 0.5.
No. There are many puzzles.
Yeah.
I mean, but I'm just talking about the phenomenology.
Okay. I agree. Yeah.
So emphasizing that different is not quite fair, because if you scale them, they are not different. All you need to do is change one parameter, T crossover, they'll be identical. They may be identical.
Okay, maybe. We don't know
I
what
do not
happens.
Know. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, I do know, because there are other data from other groups where similar behavior is seen, but not based on these data.
But near imaging, well, yeah, I guess we'll hear more about that in the next talk, yeah.
Maybe I'm the same, but slightly different way. If you compare the two curves that you showed us and try to see how...
At what filling?
Hmm?
At what filling?
The one that shows us almost as T square and this one,
yeah,
and the next one.
Yeah.
It looks at, really, it goes from almost T square to almost root T. What happens in between?
It sort of evolves smoothly, at least.
So
in
there's no linear in T region.
The only clear linear in T, and by that I mean, for instance, this, that is always concentrated only near these two fillings, at least in all the devices that I have looked at.
Up to 30 Kelvin.
That is true. Well, and for some of the devices, we do have data until 200 Kelvin. We can talk about that later.
And is it linear up there?
Yeah, that's the important question.
Well, it starts to curve down around 100 Kelvin, and that bit, so it goes, yeah, it
so
goes.
So what's the highest temperature you see T-linear? The devices where you measured up to 200 Kelvin.
I would have to look at that again. Maybe, certainly, at least 50 Kelvin or so, possibly even beyond that.
So it's considerably lower than what Corey Dean has seen.
Yeah, so I actually have, the only time I've seen Corey's data is in Shankar's slide, so... from last week, so I guess
we'll see.
What I would suggest, just for the sake of making the discussion a little more fruitful, is to basically let Dabanjan give his talk, not have much discussion, have Matt give his talk, not have much discussion, and then they can both go out there.
And maybe in the afternoon we can talk about this.
And
no, that takes us 11:45. I think it's a very good suggestion.
Yeah. So let's.
And
let's
I will open this suggestion. That means
and Andre can moderate so that we have an unbiased moderator.
That's a good idea.
Okay, sure. Okay. So
less biased.
Right. So with that, let me just summarize and the basic facts, at least as far as order 10 devices are concerned. So what we are seeing is that there's a range of density spanning roughly 10 to the 11 per centimeter squared near both nucleus plus minus 2, where we find a T-linear resistivity that extends from what I call a lower temperature scale, a Cohen's temperature, all the way to 30 Kelvin. In most of the devices, we don't have data above 30 Kelvin. Now, amazingly, this crossover scale can be as low as 0.5 Kelvin, but there is a huge device-to-device variation. So in general, it goes from 0.5 to 5 Kelvin. Now, I kept saying that the resistivity here is large. So large compared to what? So just to make it a little more quantitative, what we see here is that the resistivity approaches or even exceeds the quantum of resistance in 2D, H over E squared, divided by some degeneracy factor. So in particular, if you take G of 4, it certainly exceeds this number for this range of Fehling's near the correlated insulators, and also approaches the value for G, the value for G equals 2. And finally, the slopes in this T-linear regime appear to be large. I mean, that's kind of obvious. If it has to go from almost zero to these values in a span of just 30 degrees, it has to be large. But in the next slide, I will define what I really mean by large. So in this slide, what I'm trying to do is compare the results for magic angle bilayer graphene with just normal monolayer graphene. So the inset here actually shows data for monolayer graphene on two different substrates. I think, in fact, this data here is taken from a time when Andrea was a PhD student. So of course, in monolayer graphene, you do see a broad regime of T-linear resistivity with a slope that's nearly doping independent near charge neutrality. So in fact, Shankar talked about this in great detail in his talk last week. So I would encourage you to go listen to that talk if you're interested. And in fact, this T-linear regime in monolayer graphene can be well described by just electron scattering off acoustic phonons above some characteristic temperature scale, which happens to be the so-called Bloch-Grunstein temperature scale. The values of the resistivity are just a few hundred ohms. In magic angle graphene near the correlated insulator, the values are order kilo ohms, and the slopes, if you extract from this fitting a T-linear straight line to this resistivity, is between 100 to 300 ohms per Kelvin, compared to just 0.1 ohms per Kelvin in monolayer graphene.
Can I just make one comment here?
Yes.
The real reference is Efetov and Kim. The same effort we just gave a talk.
Yeah.
Great paper, 2010.
Yeah, sorry about that. And yeah, this reference is, in fact, RMPR.
Then you know.
Yeah. OK.